like to, you know, basically I've spent, you know, the last 43 years of my life or so working in organizational development. I've served, some people would say, well, Jerry's a fundraiser. I hate it when people introduce me as a fundraiser because usually the people that they're with step back two or three steps and they kind of reach for the back pocket to know where their wallet is, and they're just a little bit nervous about the fact that you're there and you're going to try to extract something from them that they may not necessarily want to part with. So, but basically I built a career around what I call relational development. And my conclusion is that at the end of the day, success is going to be measured in terms of ministry and in terms of how effective we've been in building relationships. Development's just all about relationships, and I think most of us know that. And we know that, you know, to the degree that we build relationships, we find more, you know, people much more responsive to what it is that we have to say. This is the my focus on relational development was probably a rebound from my years in seminary, because I spent several years in seminary getting degrees, and only to find out that the one thing that I needed to know the most was the thing that I knew the least about, because I was being placed in ministry opportunities, and while I knew the facts of what it is that I needed to know in order to be able to minister in the ways that I was hired to minister to people, I didn't have a clue about how to build relationships. And so I spent a career trying to figure that out and how to do it, not just at an individual basis, because I knew how to build relationships individually. I mean, the reality is all of us know how to do that because we do it on a pretty regular basis. You know, we meet somebody that we want to get to know, and we have, you know, our little steps that we take, and probably some of them are very similar and most are effective in really building a relationship. But I found myself in organizations that had thousands of people involved with them. I became a vice president for a university, and we had 50,000 people on our database. And then years later, I started working with an organization in America that has 5 million people on its database. And I'm sitting there scratching my head, and I don't scratch it quite as much as I used to, but the realities are, how do you do with this? How do you deal with this? And so, you know, basically, we've learned a lot about how to, you know, recognize the differences that exist between people on the database and what you can do to move them from one place to another in building a relationship, and how to track that, you know, from a standpoint that makes it possible for you to know, you know, where people are, you know, every person is on your database. And that's not what we're here to talk about, but that's essentially what it is that I do, is help organizations do that and then to use what it is that they know to build relationships that hopefully are going to be fruitful and long-lasting. But, you know, this career that I've been involved in for the last 43 years was, you know, pretty stable for many, many years. I mean, everything was just pretty much the same. We did the same things, you know, last year or 10 years ago that we were doing 10 years earlier. And so everything was kind of sailing along, and I'll be 70 years old next year. And so, you know, I'm not really thinking about retirement, but if I were thinking about retirement, I would think, well, this is a good way to kind of coast out and, you know, right on top of things. And then all of a sudden, somebody pulls the rug out from underneath us, because there's not much in philanthropy today that is the same as it was 5 or 6 years ago. There's and that's true in America, and it's true to some degree here, only by virtue of the fact that America kind of drives an awful lot of what it is that's happening in the world. And now we really do have a flat earth or whatever. We're very, very close. The community of the world is much more. When I was a child, and this was, you know, back in the 40s, you know, my parents supported a missionary in Japan. And I grew up in Maine, so which doesn't perhaps mean much to you, but if you know the map of the U.S., Maine is up in the top right-hand corner. It's that way up there near the ocean and right on the ocean, and that's where I grew up. And then we had these missionaries in Japan, and I kept asking my dad when I was a kid, I says, where's Japan? And he says that it's the end of the earth. And I really began to think that there was a sign somewhere in Japan that said the end. You know, this is like, okay, this is it. We're here. And they would go away. They'd get on a ship and they'd go to Japan, and we wouldn't see them for 7 years. They'd be gone for 7 years, and then they'd come back for a furlough for a year, and they'd come and visit us. And I kept noticing that, you know, every time they came back, they were looking a little bit older, and now obviously they're with the Lord. But that was life in the 40s and the 50s. And then I started working in development in 1970, so this is 30 or 40 years later, and basically we had a generation of people that were extremely generous, people who had come out of the war years, had built businesses, and they had money, and they were generous. They were very, very philanthropic. And that was followed by another generation that was even more philanthropic than that of their fathers. And so there's a lot of money out there, and a lot of very, very generous people who have a real heart for the Lord as it relates to Christian ministry, and they're generously supporting us. And so most of my career, I'm working in this environment where there's a lot of money available, and people are very, very anxious to give it. And then something happens. And so I want to talk to you about what's happening, and then how do we respond to it? Because, you know, there's a slide there, and I had to get these. I did this in 2011. I'm thinking, they said, can we use the same notes? And I said, sure, but would you show them to me? Because I'm not sure what it is that I said. But basically, we're talking about change, because we were talking about change in 2011, and I had been talking about it with our clients, you know, even earlier than that, during the 2006-2008 crisis period, in which really the bottom fell out in the economies of the world. So let me give you a little bit of an overview. And I hope this is not too boring, but I think you'll find it to be intriguing. And remember, I'm from America, and I'm going to be speaking about it in terms of what's happening in America. But what's happening in America is impacting what's happening everywhere else in the world. And it's certainly, if you're an overseas ministry that receives money from America, you will be impacted. So you just need to know that. And then you need to know exactly what can we do in order to build ministries that are going to be impactful as we move into the future. So that's kind of the whole theme of where it is that we're going. And if you just listen, then we'll go back and look at the notes, and I think I'll cover pretty much everything. But rather than just get bogged down and reading things, let me just kind of share with you the big picture. We are familiar with generations because the Bible talks about them frequently. You know, reading the first chapter of Matthew, you read about the generations that preceded that of Jesus, and you can track the genealogy of how and where Jesus came from. And usually a generation is somewhere between, 18 and 20 years. And so we've lived through several generations, or I've lived through several generations in the course of my lifetime. And so we know what a generation is. And in America, we put a name to them. Give them a name, because it's easy to remember than the years in which they were born. And so, one generation, in which my father was a part, was called the Great Generation. And the Great Generation, or the Greatest Generation, and the Greatest Generation, I think the dates are in here somewhere. And it's so small that you can't see it. But it was a period of time from about 1908 to about 23 or 24 or whatever. And the Greatest Generation is called the Greatest Generation because this is the generation, or it's actually probably up into the 30s or whatever. But this is the generation that went to war. They participated in World War II, and they were the ones that fought the war. Those are the ones that, that came back from the war, and they, the economy in America prior to the war was really dwindling, and now they came back to rebuild the economy of America. That's my dad's generation. They were called the Greatest Generation. There are books in America that are written about the Greatest Generation, and they're wonderfully inspiring stories of people, who had little, came out of the Depression, and then went through the war, came back, and really used all their energies and all the lessons that they'd learned from the Depression and the experiences that they had to build a very, very, begin the process of building the foundation for a very, very stable economy. And then they were followed by the next generation, which is referred to as the builders. And it was, I can't remember the beginning date, but I know that the the end date was 1946. So it would be, say, 1925 to 1946 or somewhere in there. And that was called the Builders. Now, they weren't as big a generation as their fathers. I mean, relatively small in terms of the millions of people that were represented. But they were builders. They took what Dad had done, all the foundations that had been built by the greatest generation, and they made them flourish. I mean, they built the infrastructure. You know, they had everything going. It was a time of building. It was a time of entrepreneurialism. It was a time of all kinds of things where the economy began to just really begin to boom. And then they were followed. And I'm, by the way, a builder. I was born during that era. And I was born at the end of that era, just before, you know, the beginning of the next generation, which took place in 1946. So I was kind of in the tail end of the last quarter of that last generation. And they were followed by what's called the boomers. So we've got the greatest generation, the builders, and the boomers. And the boomers were the largest generation in American history. And you need to know about the boomers because all of you have benefited in one way or another from the boomers. There were 78 million of them. So it was the largest generation in American history. And they're the most generous generation in American history. They are responsible even today for giving or driving 90% of all the giving that takes place, charitable giving that takes place in America to this day. They still are earning 70% of all the money being earned in America. And they're giving 90% of all the money that's being given. They're either giving it themselves or they're in positions where they're making decisions, you know, choices on behalf of organizations to delegate or to designate money to certain areas. And if you want to put that in dollar and cents terms, I'll use U.S. dollars. Last 2011, I think, is the last year we have the complete records for giving in America. And in 2011, close to $400 billion was given to charity. $400 billion. And 90% of that was given by baby boomers. So 90% of $400 billion is $360 billion. Now that's just an awful lot of money. And baby boomers are responsible for all of it. So they're pretty important to us. Your organization and many other organizations like yours, at least in America, have been built on the backs of the baby boomers. They're the ones that saw the vision. They're the ones that gave the money. And they're the ones that are beginning to die. Because the oldest of the baby boomers is now well past, you know, in the late 60s. They're retiring. And they're retiring at the rate of 10,000 a day. And that retirement rate is going to continue for the next 12 to 15 years. Now, right now, they're making 70% of all the money being earned in America. But by the year 2018, they'll be making 20% of all the money that's being made in America. And it's projected by the year 2018, the giving of baby boomers could go down as much as 70%. That is absolutely huge. And it's going to impact charities because the generations that succeed the baby boomers are not picking up the slack. Now, there are two generations since the baby boomers. Baby boomers, 1946 to 1964. The next generation is called the busters. So we've got the builders, the boomers, the busters. And the busters are oftentimes referred to as the X generation. And they are a relatively small generational group, 45 or 48 million, as opposed to the 78 million baby boomers. They're making 20% of all the money being earned in America right now. And that's probably going to stay pretty stable because they're really well established. I mean, most of those are 30 years old to 50 something. And so they're pretty stable and they're giving, you know, a little bit less than 10%. They're giving about 8% or so of the money that's being given in America today. So that $400 billion, they're giving about, you know, $32 billion of that. And so they still are donating. They're still giving. And they're still an important part of what it is. But their giving's not going to go up substantially. So that's not the generation that we're terribly concerned about, because they're pretty stable. We kind of know where they are. But the next generation is the problem. And it's the answer. And that's the generation that we call in America the millennials. These are the people that were born, you know, between 1980 and 2000. So it's a 20-year period of time. There are over 80 million of them, which makes them the largest generation in American history. They are only making 5% of all the money being earned in America. By the year 2018, they'll be making 55% of all the money being earned in America. Of the 80-plus million, 20% of themselves consider themselves to be spiritually minded. In other words, they could be Buddhist, you know, or could be just about anything. I mean, they just have spiritual, you know, feelings, and they want to act upon those, and they're really not, you know, all settled. But of the 20%, only 10% of them are going to churches. And they're very, very different, and they have some very, very commendable qualities. Let me talk about some of the commendable qualities that they have. They're extremely well-educated. They're very, very smart. They're very, very entrepreneurial. They're very, very, they have really good self-esteem. In fact, it's called the narcissistic generation. You know, they think the world kind of revolves around them. There was an article, actually, we have a news magazine in America called Time Magazine that comes out every week. And about 3 weeks ago, I have a copy actually in my briefcase. I should have brought it down because you'd have been amused by the cover story. But the story is just all about, it's called the me generation. And there on the cover of Time Magazine is a millennial laying on the floor taking a picture of herself. And that kind of, in the minds of the editors, that described, you know, a little bit about who they are. They just are, you know, really consumed with themselves. They have incredible aspirations. All of them want to be, you know, president or something else. You know, they all think that, you know, they're going to change the world. They're incredibly optimistic. They're the most relational generation in American history. They all have these Facebook accounts. They're all involved in social media, be it Facebook or Twitter or whatever. They're communicating with one another. If you really want to have fun, if you ever come to America, I always do this because, you know, I'll go into a restaurant and there'll be a young, you know, lady that may be the host, the hostess, or a young man, the waiter, or whatever. And I'll oftentimes look and say, "You got a Facebook account?" "Oh, yeah, yeah." "How many followers do you have?" "Oh, 1,173. I mean, like they know the number of followers that they have. And in their minds, all of these are my pals. We're all friends. And I'm thinking, you can't have 1,173 friends. I've got six, you know. I mean, I have lots of people that I know, but when it comes to really close friends with whom I have a deep personal relationship, wherein I would share my thoughts and I'd share my fears and I'd share my concerns, that number is really pretty small. Now, I do have a Facebook account, and I think I've got like 700 or 800 followers, but, you know, go figure. But most of them, I don't even know who they are. And so this is the millennials. They change jobs every 1.5 years. So it's not like they, you know, my dad, probably your dad, I don't know, but my dad had a job and he had it all of his life. He just did the same thing all of his life. And then he retired. And that's just what he did. And your dad probably did the same. But these people just, you know, move around and they make money because they need to spend money, but they only make as much money as they need to spend. In other words, they don't have a lot of, they're actually better parents than most of my generation were. Because they're called the helicopter parents. They kind of hover over their kids and they know that every birth that comes from a millennial is an academically advanced child. And they want to be involved in picking every part of their curriculum so that they can become all that they want to be or all that they could be. And all of them could be, obviously, executives and very, very successful in life. And so they're, you know, teachers complain about the millennials because the parents don't go away. And there's constantly, you know, checking in and checking on them and in an effort to try to make sure that they're getting, you know, their child is getting what it is that they deserve, being as advanced as they are in academics and every other form of life. And so the realities are they're very, very interesting. They think their fathers are hypocrites. although they really admire older people. So I've got something going for me here. I mean, they admire older people and they want to be mentored by older people and so forth because they really do respect them at one level, but they think by and large that we're all a bunch of hypocrites. And the reason they think we're hypocrites is because Dad's way of doing things was different. You see, they would go to their dads and they might say to their dad, you know, Dad, there are people dying of starvation in Somalia. And the dad would say, you're kidding. Oh yeah, there's just lots of people that are dying, you know, of starvation in Somalia, and it's just a terrible travesty, and you know, something needs to be done. He says, you know, you are right. And he goes out and he reaches into his drawer, he picks up his checkbook and writes a check for $1,000. And he gives it to his son or his daughter and says, go, do something about it. And that was Dad's attitude. Write a check, you know, you go do something about it. I'm going to stay doing what it is I'm doing, building my empire or whatever it is that they were seeking to develop. And so the millennials say, you know, that's hypocritical. I mean, you say you're concerned, but you write a check and that just soothes your guilt and gives you at least the feeling that you're doing something, you know, of real worth. So what they do, and it's true with all generations, we kind of go to extremes. It's like the pendulum, you know, here we are over here, now we're over here. And then eventually it kind of settles in the middle if you wait long enough, if it's not, you know, functioning properly. But the realities are they've kind of gone over to this extreme. And that is they get involved. And I mean, they seriously get involved. I wrote a book here not long ago. It was entitled, You Snooze, You Lose. And the subtitle of the book is, you know, Thriving in a Turbulent Economy. And essentially what I'm saying by the title is that if you go to sleep tonight, as many people are sleeping tonight, and you believe, or you at least hope, that when you wake up in the morning, everything's going to be all better. It's going to be just the way it was, you know, 15 years ago, and everything's going to be thriving, and people are going to continue to be given. If you go to sleep thinking that everything's going to be all better in the morning, you lose. Because now we have in front of us some of the greatest, the most significant opportunities to reach a generation than we've ever had in American history. And the only way we're going to be able to do that is to adapt. We just have to adapt our ministries for change. Now, if I were to tell you, and what I would like you all to do is to imagine, or I'm going to tell you that in 6 to 8 years, there's going to be 70% less money available to you than what you have now. 70% less. And I believe that's going to happen in America, and I think the ripple effect of that's going to triple over to everything that you're doing. If you're receiving money from American sources, or if you're getting people that are giving from America, I mean, anticipate, you know, about a 70% loss of what it is that you're getting today, you know, 7 or 8 years from now. Because it's inevitable. I mean, you can go to Google and you can track it. I mean, it's not like this is Jerry's opinion. Everybody in the world of philanthropy right now is deeply concerned about this because the millennials aren't picking up their slack of what it is that the baby boomers have released. And so I speak at conferences all the time. I was speaking at Baylor University a few months ago, and it was a symposium in which I was a plenary speaker on the 21st century nonprofit. And I spoke for about an hour and a half on this topic, and then there was time for questions. And someone who represented the church looked at me and he says, how do I know if we're vulnerable? You know, he's talking about a church. I mean, are there ways to tell if you're vulnerable? I says, you're a church, right? And he says, yeah. I says, well, look at me. Because if everybody in your church looks like me, or the majority of the people look like me, you're in trouble. And it's not because I'm bad, it's because I'm old. And those people aren't going to be around. And if you're the masses of the, if the great number of people in your congregation look like me, and they're not being replaced by people coming into the church because the millennials aren't coming into the church, then you're in trouble. If 70% of your income as an organization comes from people that look like me, you're going to face the same dilemma. And so the changes that are in front of us are really, you know, somewhat monumental. And so we're helping a lot of organizations kind of adapt to the situation. We call, you know, this, I call what it is that's happening now a tsunami. It's the tsunami that basically is coming towards shore right now. And it's going to be followed by several other tsunamis that are right behind it in our country. So it's not like there's one tsunami wave and it's going to be over and then we can take a deep breath. There's like six or eight others right behind it that are going to have equal economic impact in the country in which I live. Now, I don't know how much you know about tsunamis. I think you've probably all read. Now we've seen them, you know, in real time. I mean, when the Japanese quake took place, it happened during the day and the technology was there so helicopters could fly out to the ocean and watch the tsunami wave come in. And you all saw what happened. Tsunami waves can be up to 150 feet in height. They travel across the surface of the water at 500 miles an hour. And one of the telltale signs that something's about to happen is the fact that if you're sitting on the beach, the water starts to go down. Now, in the Indonesian tsunami in 2001, there's some very, very interesting pictures you can pick up on the internet that I kind of study and I just look at because I'm intrigued. But here there are people, you know, in Indonesia, you know, on the beach, underneath an umbrella, you know, reading their book and periodically looking up and noticing that the water's going down. They just say, well, that's really interesting. Then it must be the tide's going down. And then they go back to reading their book and they come back and say, well, the water's really going down. Did you see that? The water's really going down. And everybody said, yeah, that's really interesting. Must be a real low tide today. And then they start reading again. And, you know, they look up a little bit later and the boat that was on 30 foot of water that was moored just out offshore about 40, you know, or 50 yards, you know, is now on dry ground. And they says, you know, this is really a low tide. I mean, this is really pretty unbelievable. Look at all the water that's going out. And here they are looking at it, reading their books and sitting underneath their umbrellas while the 500 mile an hour wave, 150 feet high, is racing toward them. And most of them died. Now, it's not a lot unlike that in the world today. You're sitting on the beach and the water's going down. And, you know, next year it's going to go down a little bit further, and the next year it's going to go a little bit further, and all of a sudden, you know, you can almost see the wave or see it in the horizon. And when you see it on the horizon, you know, it's probably too late. It's probably too late to do anything. And so I just really want you to be aware of the fact that I'm trying to build, obviously, a sense of the fact that things are going to change and we need to adapt. Now, there are four things, and this isn't in your notes, but I think this is something that you need to kind of keep in mind. There are four things that are going to define philanthropy in the 21st century, okay? And these are very, very important, and they're going to, you know, be the basis of some of the things I'm going to conclude with. Well, what can you do? How do we, you know, respond to this so that we don't just, you know, survive, but we thrive? So the first of these four things that are going to define philanthropy is return on investment. Return on investment. That's a term that most of us are familiar with. If you were going to buy stock or if you were going to buy something, you know, that was speculative, you know, somebody's asking you to invest in a new startup company or something of that nature, and they're asking you for money, but you're going to get something in return, but you want to know what you're going to get in return. What could I expect? I mean, if I'm going to give you, you know, $20,000, you know, what could I expect in terms of return on investment? And you better be able to give a rational answer or else, you know, they're probably not going to invest. Because of the current economic crisis that started in 2008 and continues in our country, it's, you know, people are feeling a little bit better because the stock market's going up, which is really artificial because, you know, businesses have more money now because they're not spending any money and they're putting it into R&D. And they're finding new ways and more efficient ways to do the same thing without employing new people. So we have high unemployment. That's a problem. That's not going to necessarily change. So there's a lot of things that are happening. But nonetheless, you know, it would be, you know, I don't think this is the tide so low right yet because, look, I mean, you know, things, you know, relatively speaking, by measurements that we typically use to measure, you know, profitability and so forth, we're not doing as bad as we were in 2008, and it seems to be improving like it's going to get better. No, it's not going to get better. But people, you know, that are donors have less money to give. Giving goes down, and I suspect that many of you have experienced some kind of a decline in giving over the last few years because giving's going down because people in our country, the baby boomers, and I'm speaking on behalf of our country, but I don't think it's just unique to us. I mean, you know, go to Iceland. And you'll find that, you know, there are a lot of people that are really apprehensive about the economy because look what happened to them. You know, their whole economic program just dropped into the bucket. They just lost everything. All the banks closed. And so now you're asking them for money and they're saying, you know, I'm generous and I'd love to give. But let me tell you, they're hedging, you know, their gifts based upon the uncertainty of what's going to happen in the future. And so, you know, people are going to, and the people that are giving are much more, and this is true with your organization as well as any other organization that I know in the country, and that is, or in the world, and that is that people want their money to go further. If I only have, let's say I used to give $20,000 a year, and now I'm giving $10,000 a year, I want my $10,000 a year to do as much as my $20,000 a year was doing. In other words, I'm going to look for opportunities that basically allow me to leverage that money to the fullest extent of its possibilities for maximum kingdom impact. And so when you're talking to donors, when you're talking to people, you've got to talk about return on investments because they're very, very coy right now. They're very, very sharp. They're very, very intuitive, and they're looking for things. So, you know, the idea of just giving a gift and not being concerned about what happens to it are days, you know, remnants of days gone by. That's not going to be the case in the future. People are very, very discretionary. They're very, very discerning, and they're extremely demanding. They want to see annual reports. They want to see where their money's going. And so if you're not doing an annual report to donors, you need to start doing that, where you're sharing with them what it is that happened as a result of their gifts. You want to affirm them in their gifts and let them know that you are good stewards of that which was entrusted to you. So return on investment is huge. Number two, sustainability. A lot of you know, donors are concerned about the stability of the organizations that they're supporting. You know, there are all kinds of horror stories out there of people that gave you know, a nonprofit a $1 million gift. And then, you know, the next morning they wake up and they see the headlines of the paper that nonprofit to whom they gave $1 million yesterday is claiming bankruptcy today. And the $1 million that they thought was going to expand ministry and to impact the lives of people is now being used to satisfy, you know, the debtors that are making claims against the organization. And you know, that doesn't have to happen too many times. And these stories are, you know, all written about in the Chronicle of Philanthropy and the Journal of Higher Education. I could bring you, you know, story after story after story, similar stories of the same, you know, the same situation. So everybody's kind of saying, you know, they want to know that you're stable. And the other thing that they're looking for is this, and this is what you need to be looking for. So just kind of, you know, bear with me on this because I know you think, well, gee, that may be true in America. I said, no, it's not just true in America, it's true everywhere. But what donors are concerned about is, are you doing anything that is going to reduce your dependence upon donors? I mean, are you doing anything that basically is going to provide another source of income or multiple sources of income that is going to enable you to succeed if the donors disappeared? Because the donors are going to go away. They're not all going to go away. But those that are staying are not going to be giving as much. Now, I'm not a pessimist. You have to understand that I'm the biggest optimist in the world. I have never seen a half-empty thing of anything. You know, I'm just like, oh, yeah, this is a great thing. I'm just really, you know, pretty excited about things. I'm very excited about where we're living right now because I think we have days of unparalleled opportunity in the ministries that we represent. So, you know, organizations are doing a lot of really creative things, and I think this is where what it is that you're working on is going to be so important to the future. Let me give you a couple of examples. I'm working with a high school in America. It's in Kansas City, if you know where Kansas City is, but it's in America, and this is a high school that has about 250 students, and they're building a new high school. And it's going to cost them a lot of money. But they've lost enrollment because, you know, cost of, you know, private school education has gone up to a point where many families are saying, I'm not sure that it's, I mean, as much as I want it, I'm not sure that we can afford it, especially if we've got five kids and they're all paying $4,000 or $5,000 a year, which is really pretty inexpensive for a high school, private high school education in America. Five times 5 is 25,000. And a lot of people are going to say, I'm not sure that, I mean, as much as we want it, the much we know how valuable it is, I'm not sure that we can afford it. And so this school, you know, and we've been a part of the decision-making process because we've been guiding them through this, because we've been telling them the same thing that I'm telling you. We've got to figure out ways, can we develop multiple sources of income? So one of the things that they're doing, because here they are in Kansas City, and around them, within 15 or 20 miles max, I mean, they took a 20-mile radius of you know, ground zero, and they kind of drew a circle around it, and they found like 12 communities of like 7,500 student 7,500 families or 7,500 people in them. So here there are the 12 different communities of 7,500 that don't have a prayer to ever have a Christian high school. I mean, there's just no chance that they're going to do that because it's expensive and they don't have the resources. But many of them, you know, have expressed a great desire to do it, but we can't afford, you know, $5,000 or $6,000 a year. But we really want, you know, a high quality, value-based Christian educational experience for our kids. And so this school said, we can provide that. We can provide that. If you can, you know, find a church that's got, you know, 3 or 4 classrooms that they'd open up and, you know, a screen, what we're going to do is we will bring, you know, 2 full-time faculty members to your location, and we will live stream classes, you know, from our site where a teacher now is teaching students. They're going to see it on the screen. We have the technology where you can ask questions and they can interact in the classroom, and we can provide you a full secondary Christian educational experience, a value-based Christian educational experience for your community. And instead of charging you $5,000, we're only going to charge you $1,000 a semester, which is $2,000, which is a good deal cheaper than what it is they were going to get it before. And they can get a diploma from that school. And that was true with all of the 12 locations. They had all 12 locations that said, sign us up. That's what we want, because this is what we want for our kids. The realities are what they're doing is they're making more money than they've ever made before. And profitability in Christian schools have never been in a sentence before now. Because they just never—it's never been heard of. I mean, being profitable as an educational institution, they're expanding their ministry, they're increasing their profits, and they're reaching more kids with what it is that the kids want and their parents want for them. Now, to me, that just makes an awful lot of sense. And where you have a teacher over here that was one time teaching 25 students, who's now teaching 250—that's really leveraging a resource, isn't it? Because now we're getting more impact from the giftedness of that particular teacher. We're able to pay her more because she gets a stipend for every student that's enrolled in one of these, you know, remote classes. So now her income has increased by about 20%. She's really a whole lot happier. He's a whole lot happier than he's ever been before. And he's having a greater impact for the kingdom of God. Now, to me, that's just kind of a neat thing. Now, the other player in our country that is really hurting right now is the Christian college. This is it's the Christian college with about 3,000 students or less. I mean, we have some really large Christian colleges like Wheaton and Biola and Westmont and Taylor University and so forth. Well, Taylor's not as big as the others. But those big three, you know, so to speak, they're charging as much as, you know, $50,000 or $60,000 a year to go to school there. And that's not becoming as acceptable as it once was. Because what's happened in America is we've said, oh, you know, that may be expensive, or what the teacher or the organization, the school was saying, you know, it's pretty expensive, but we got all kinds of aid, and we can get you some financial support or financial aid from grants from the government. And so all these students are running to the government to get grants or loans. And they're very, very competitive in terms of their interest rate. And you know, an 18-year-old, you know, can borrow now, you know, $20,000 or $30,000. And what does an 18-year-old know about $20,000 or $30,000? Not an awful lot. And his parents are crazy enough to let him take out the loan. And so he takes out this loan for, say, $20,000. he has, and they say, listen, you can use it on education, you can use it to pay books, you can use it to, you know, do a lot of things. I mean, the realities are this is money, you can use it for education, and that's just fine. If you need a little bit more, we can probably help you. So now this student's going in school, every year collecting a debt of $20,000 or $25,000. It totally, buying things indiscriminately because he can or she can. And then they graduate, and they graduate with $100,000 of debt. Now, usually what happens in Christian colleges, you know, when there's boys and girls in the same college, usually the boys and the girls get together, and then they fall in love, and they get married. Now, stop and think about this. You marry a girl with $100,000 of debt, and you have $100,000 in debt. Now, I say 100 plus 100 equals $200,000 in debt. Now, how many of you think that's going to be just the joyous, most happy, the most free marriage that you've ever seen in your life? You say, that's just not going to happen, and it's not going to happen. It's not because the kids don't love the Lord, they don't love each other. You know, the number one reason for divorces, you know, within 10 years in America is finances. And most of them, if you track it back, about 80% of those are those with student loans that can never be forgiven. You can claim bankruptcy, but you can't claim bankruptcy on a student loan. So you're always going to have it with you. Well, you know, parents are kind of, you know, catching wind of all of this. They kind of figured it out a little bit too late. But by the way, there's only one area of debt in America that's greater than student loans, and that's people who pay mortgages on houses. After that, that's the most significant form of debt. We already owe $19 trillion in America, and now we have this horrible crisis of literally billions of dollars, you know, of student loans that are in default, and a revolution taking place among students demanding relief, which would only increase the national debt, which only increase the tax reform issues that are driving us. I mean, I'm telling you, it's a mess. And so, you know, something's got to be done. And it would be easy to say, because we've lost 3,000 Christian schools, and there are many colleges that are on the brink of closing, it would be easy for us to sit back and say, well, that's really too bad. That was a good run. No, did we? We had a good run, but we're just, now it's over. That's really too bad. Now, I'm not prepared to say that. I don't think there are a lot of people in America that are. But the realities are, what are we going to do? Well, I'm kind of one of the guys, I'm not certainly the only guy, but I'm one of the guys that try to ruffle everybody's feathers, you know, by, you know, kind of, you know, saying something absurd. But I just had this real incredible vision and an incredible burden to do something, because I don't think we can sit by and just let this happen. So I bought a bunch of airplane tickets, you know, to go to different colleges around the country, Christian colleges around, you know, our country. You know, popped in to see the presidents, because I know most of the presidents, or many of the presidents, pretty well. And I just called up and said, hey, listen, let's get together for coffee and I'll fly out to see you. And I did. And I'd sit down in their offices and I said, listen, I got a vision. Here's my vision. And, you know, this wasn't a Damascus Road experience or anything like that. No donkey talked to me. So don't be alarmed. But I really did have a vision, you know, of what we could do. I says, imagine. I says, I've identified, 1,200 communities in America over 50,000 or 60,000. And I'm going around to Christian colleges because here's what I think you need to do, or at least to consider. You can take your accreditation and you can go to one of those schools and you can set up a 2-year Christian community college in those cities. And instead of charging $1,600 an hour, that's what it costs at Biola University to take 1 hour of education, $1,600. 2 hours, $3,200. Multiply that times 32 hours, which is the average load that the average person is taking in the course of a year, and you know how much you're paying for tuition. And the realities are, that's just not, you know, for most people. I understand there'll always be people that will be able to pay that, but for most people, that's not even on their radar screen. I says, but what if you could go over here to this city? Your accreditation will follow you. And you can offer, you know, a series of associate degrees that would basically cover all the core courses that they would need to enter into four or five different, you know, areas of you know, expertise or discipline. And you could do it for $200 an hour. And make money. Make money. You see, you've got fixed costs. You're renting space in a building. You're hiring adjunct faculty, and you're charging, you know, $200 an hour or whatever the case might be. And you know that the break-even point, you know, is, you know, 12 kids in a class. So you never have less than 12 kids in a class. You try to get 18 or 20 kids in a class, and now it becomes profitable. And it becomes immensely profitable. There are for-profit educational colleges in America right now that are thriving. And you know, if we could get 1,200, you know, maybe my aspiration's a bit high, but if we could get 1,200 Christian community colleges in America, you know, Christian education could be available for everybody. And so rather than retract, you know, why don't we expand the availability of Christian education, and maybe we can capture this generation of young people for Jesus Christ. Now, to me, that just makes, you know, really a lot of sense. And some of my college presidents said, well, that's a very intriguing idea, and thank you for coming, we'll see you. And others of them said, that's a really intriguing idea, let's look into it. And some of them have actually done it. And I think that's going to be the movement of the future if we're going to preserve Christian education, value-based Christian education. You know, it's really interesting. We've even focused on the value-based part of the equation. Because you have to understand that millennials are not really all that concerned about Christian education. But they are immensely concerned about values. You know, 20%, you know, have spiritual, you know, interest. 10% are, you know, going to church. So you're not going to do an awful lot of, you know, success, you know, recruiting in that area. I mean, you can still obviously recruit me because 20% of 80 million is still a lot of people. But the realities are the vast majority of them, you know, 90% or 95% feel like values are deteriorating in America, that the values that our parents had, which they value, you know, are not present in this new generation. So I've been a real advocate of saying, let's talk about value-based, and if you want to call it Christian, that's fine, I don't have any problem, but let's make sure that we get value-based in there, because that's the thing they're concerned about. And you know something? They don't care if it's a Buddhist school. If I can send them to a Buddhist school or an Islamic school and they're going to get values, that's what I'm concerned about. I want my kid to have values. Well, why shouldn't we, as blood-bought believers in Jesus Christ, take the lead on this rather than always be the followers and find out that we came up short because we lacked vision and the courage to do something that was right? So that's another way of building sustainability. We have a couple of colleges, actually, or seminaries in my network. One of them is the president of Tyndale Seminary in Amsterdam. The other one's the president of Warsaw Theological Seminary in Warsaw here in Poland. And I said, you know, if I were you guys, you know what I'd do? We were talking about this morning. I said, you know what, I would make it my goal in life to make sure that our school was going to be, if no other school is going to do this, then let it be us. And if other schools are going to do it, then praise God. But I would say for at least my school, we're going to do everything we can to train up this next generation of Christian leaders to take their place in the world. And we can offer certificate programs. We can do, you know, associates programs. We'll do whatever we need to do to prepare this generation. And we can do most of it through, you know, streaming classes, online learning, some of the stuff that you're doing. I mean, the reality is that we've got to change the way we're doing things because everything else has changed. And if we think we can just have a school and everybody's going to pay $40,000 a year to come to it and everybody's going to graduate and feel really good about themselves, you know, and know the $80,000 debt that they just accumulated, you know, if we think that's going to happen, it's not. So sustainability is huge. Number three is leveraging. Now, this is kind of a little bit redundant because we've talked about leveraging. In other words, you know, what do you have that you can leverage? Now, you have, in some instances, you have facilities. Is there a way that I could leverage my facilities? You know, 90% of, you know, the churches in America are only used one day a week. Now, that's just kind of sad. You know, we have a church that our company does church buildings, and I don't do that, but our company does. And so we just built a church in Portland, Oregon. And you know what it is? It's a Christian convention center that's used on Sunday for church. And 6 days a week, it's a convention center. It's Christian, which means that they get better service than they get anywhere else. It's less expensive than they get anywhere else. It's the most popular venue for conferences and conventions and special dinners and all these kinds of things. They built it with in mind with the fact that they make enough to pay for the building and actually most of the pastoral staff. And so all the money and tithes and offerings is going to ministry. Now, isn't that a novel idea? Who would have ever thought of that? And that's leveraging a resource. We have to have a place to worship, but why don't we just build it so that we can generate enough income from it that basically is going to enable us to expand our ministry and to reach out to more people. And everybody that comes to the convention center, it's such a great experience because, you know, everybody treats them well. You know, they staff it with people within the congregation who love the Lord, and they're taught about how to be hospitable to one another and to love one another and to care for one another and so forth. And so everybody says, man, this is like the greatest experience ever. We've never been to a place like this. We've never been to a place like this. A lot of mega churches right now are doing satellite congregations. And they're doing, like our church is a mega church. My pastor's here. His name is Aaron Brockett. If you haven't met Aaron, he's just like a real great guy. You should just go up and say, hey, Aaron, Jerry says you're a good guy. Okay. But you know, we're going to have 18 satellite congregations all throughout the area where we are. And you know, most of them look like coffee shops with a big area in the back, you know, where tables are set up, you know, for people to have coffee during the week. And all the millennials are there all week long, working hard, doing ministry, doing the things that, you know, essentially, you know, millennials like to do. It's ministry on, you know, at the site. You know, we're on the ground doing ministry in that community in very, very significant ways. You know, it's the most popular meeting place in the community because everything is done just super, super well. It generates enough income to sustain itself. And guess what we do on Sunday morning? We go into that back room and we live stream the worship service from our main campus to all these locations. And we're reaching more people more cost-effectively, doing things where ministry is taking place, which is really something millennials want to do. In my book, You Snooze, You Lose, I make this statement, which really caught the eyes of some of the reviewers. It goes something like this. It would be more likely for a millennial to make an impulsive decision to go to Uganda for a year than to put $10 in an offering plate. Now, how many don't believe that? It would be more likely for a millennial, that person in that age group, to make an impulsive, emotional decision to go to Uganda for a year than to put $10 in an offering plate. Yeah, Uganda? Sure, let's go, you know. And they'll go to Uganda for a year, and then they might come back and go to Rwanda after that, or may, you know, come to Poland or come to your country or whatever the case might be, because that's kind of like the way they are. They haven't thought about retirement. They haven't thought about anything. They're thinking about what it is that they want to do to make a difference. And if that can make a difference, then that's what they want to get involved in. So we've got to figure out how we can leverage resources. What you know is a resource. So I don't know much about anything, honestly. I mean, my wife says I'm pathetic. You know, something needs to be repaired in our house. She repairs it. You know, I says, honey, we need to fix that. Would you go take care of that? And she's like, she's part Polish, and Polish people are just like really good. They can figure out. I mean, every Polish person that I know is an engineer. I mean, they're just, you know, they draw pictures and they do things. And I'm thinking that's really pretty neat. But I don't do that. I grew up, you know, doing something else. I don't know what it was, but I know something about development. Because 43 years and 3,500 clients later and about $2 billion, you know, that has been basically raised to support the work of Christian ministries around the world. You know, I think I know a little bit about development. And the realities are, you know, I could keep it to myself, or I could try to figure out ways that I can share it with anybody else. And so I write books periodically, and that's leverage as a resource. It's something that I have up here that I can share with others through writing. But you know what I do every Monday morning? Well, it airs every Monday morning. But I have something in my office that's about that big, and it's about that thick. It's solid state. Paid $1,000 for it. Okay? I've got a camera that I paid $150 for. And I have a tripod that I paid $10 for. Okay? So I've got $1,260 wrapped up, or $160, you know, wrapped up in my little investment. Okay? Here's what I do. I go to my office, and I'll take that little black box, I'll plug it into a power source, and then I'll take my Wi-Fi connecting, you know, the actual connection, you know, direct connection into the little black box. And then I have this camera, and I have, you know, a power cord that I plug that in, and then I plug in another thing, and I'm not really, you know, as handy as you. I can even do this without my wife helping me. She helped me the first, you know, 27 times, and then she says, "Do you have it yet?" And I says, "I think I've got it already." So then I plugged it in, and I put it in. I've got a red, I've got a yellow, and I've got a white, and I can kind of look at the color codes, and I put these things in. I go to my computer. I don't need special software. I go to my computer to a website that recognizes that it sees the fact that I've got everything going. I say I'm going to do a seminar. I tell it what the seminar is. I say when I want it to start, and I go sit in a chair, and when the countdown comes, go, I say, "Hi, everybody, this is Jerry Twombly. I'm talking to you from Indianapolis, Indiana. We're going to talk about this today, development." It's 5 to 7 minutes, and you know what? Over 1,000 people around the world watch it every single week, and it's free. Now, I think that's leveraging a resource. It's just like saying, you know, I know something about this. Why should I keep it to myself? You know, you don't have to pay me for it, for crying out loud. I'll tell you for free, and if you want to listen, then that's great, and if you don't, that's okay, too. But at least it's no hair off my back. It takes me 30 minutes a week to do it, and I can afford the 30 minutes because I think it's well worthwhile. At least it is for about 1,200 people. Actually, if you want it, I can send you an email address. I'll give you my email address. Send me an email address and say, "I want to be on the list." And all you'll get is one email a week, okay? And it will tell you, you know, it's available. And it will give you a URL link, and you just click on it. You can watch it on your phone. You can watch it on your iPad. You don't need special computers. You can watch it on your computer. You can do anything that you want with it. And it, like, that just makes sense. That's leveraging a resource. And most organizations don't think about that. But now they're thinking about it because they got to think about it. Okay? And then the fourth one, what time are you going to put that 10-minute thing up? Okay, just checking, because I know he's getting ready. He's kind of, you know, like, it's like, "It's coming, Jerry, it's coming." I just figure I better know when it's coming, so at least I won't be, you know, shocked by it, and I can kind of finish up some thoughts that I really want to share with you. Okay, so the last one, the first one was, you know, return on investment. The second one was sustainability. The third one was, you know, leveraging your resources. The fourth one is outcomes. Outcomes. It's not in your notes, by the way, so you could look there for a couple of hours and you wouldn't find it. Sorry about that. You know, I changed those and I didn't tell anybody. Outcomes. This is the hottest word in development today. This is the, you know, charitable foundations, you know, they know how to spell it, and they're making sure that you know how to spell it, because this is like really, really, really important. They're not concerned about outputs as much as they are outcomes. And usually when we're talking about our ministry to potential donors and other people that really believe in us, we're talking about outputs. We can, you know, we graduate students with an average SAT score of, you know, 1400, when the average in the nation is about, you know, 1275. You know, we have, you know, 90% of our kids go to, you know, first-tier Christian colleges or universities, you know. And so we tell all those outputs, and that's kind of impressive, you know, like, wow, that's pretty good. But if you go to a charitable foundation, a Christian charitable foundation in America, they're going to say, "Well, that's really interesting, and that's good. Thank you for providing that information. Oh, by the way, what we would like is we'd like a list of your graduates for 2003. We want all the contact information on your graduates, and we want to contact your graduates from 2003. That's 10 years ago. And it would seem logical to think that people that had been through your incredible institution would be doing incredible things in 2000, 10 years later. And so we're going to take your mission statement, and we're going to say, well, this is what this mission statement would look like, or what we would expect it would look like, you know, if it was really adopted by someone and they left 10 years later, it would be reflected in some of the things that they're involved in. And so they come up with a series of maybe 20 questions. They send it to all the, you know, all the students that graduated in 2003, only to find out in many instances that some of these kids aren't doing anything that has anything to do with what it is that they were exposed to in the context of their quote-unquote Christian educational experience. In fact, the statistic in many instances was so low that it was almost embarrassing. The kids that graduated from a public school versus those that graduated from a Christian school, there was less than a 5% difference in terms of their likelihood to forsake their faith when they went to college. And everybody's saying, you know, is it worth it? Is it worth it if that's the only result we're getting? And many of the investors, the people that are doing that, are saying, I don't think so. Now, basically what it's done, you know, to many people is it's caused them to think that basically our responsibility to our graduates goes beyond, you know, the 4 years that we have them with us. And we need to be a part of their lives and so forth and so on. And I could go on and talk about that, and I would love to, but we don't have time. But the point is that outcomes are very important. And you need to answer the question, and these are the questions that you need to answer. You need to answer the question, what would we want a church member in our church now? Whether it's a person that's 13 years old, what would we want to see them look like at the age 23? What would we want to see a parent, you know, with young newborns in their home? What would we want to see those kids looking like in 10 years? What would we want to see a senior citizen like me look like 10 years because the church still ministers to me? And what should I be doing, you know, in ways of ministry? How would I look differently because I've been involved in this church for the last 10 years? I mean, we've got to think beyond today. There's a concept in development that goes something like this. When you're talking to people about your organization, lead with your vision and not with your need. Lead with your vision and not with your need. You see, when you're talking to people, everybody's got needs. I could go to Sam and say, hey, Sam, I got this incredible need. And Sam says, well, tell me about it, Jerry. I'm really interested. And so he sits down and I say, well, we need to do this, that, and the other thing. And I just would like you to consider being a partner with us and helping us get this done. And Sam says, well, that's really great, Jerry. He says, well, let me just tell you about some of my needs. And so he's talking to me about his needs. And all of a sudden, if my need doesn't outtrump his need, I lose. Or he loses, one or the other. One of us is going to perceive, it's perceived loss. But the realities are, you know, if the vision is compelling, it's gain for everybody. Because now I can invest in something that's really making a difference. Now, he's about to do it. There you saw it. It just went up. 10 minutes. There's one other thing that I think is going to happen, and I want you to just kind of think about this. But I think this is going to happen. I really do. And I've got as much right to prognosticate as anybody else, so I'm going to prognosticate with you. And I'm going to tell you a story. My children say, you know, Dad, you're like a skyscraper. A story after story after story after story after story after story. So I'm going to tell you another story, okay? And it's a true story. I have been really involved over the course of my career in trying to address the incredible tragedy that's taking place in America in abortions. And so, and there's a lot of background behind that, but this is something, and it's not because we ever had an abortion, but my mother was very, very active when I was a child working with young ladies that were experiencing a crisis pregnancy. That was back in the 1940s. And that's when, you know, if a girl got pregnant that wasn't married, it was a huge embarrassment upon families. And so, you know, families would send their daughter somewhere just to get her out of town so that she wouldn't have to, you know, accept the rejection of others, and they wouldn't have to face, you know, the ostracization that oftentimes would occur. And if you ever wondered where all those people were, they were all at my house in Maine. Just want you to know that. My mother would take them in, and she would, you know, she had a one-man show here. She was doing adoption. She was doing everything. She was just absolutely incredible. And she was doing it in our home. And so I can tell you more about that, but I won't in the interest of time. But I've always, you know, we have a lot of what we call pregnancy care centers, and they're called different things in America. But but their efforts by evangelicals and Christians basically to encourage people to look at the other option. You know, pro-choice doesn't mean that you can make a choice for death. It also means you can make a choice for life. And so the pro-choice road has been kind of, you know, you'd have to be an American to really understand that perhaps. But nonetheless, I'm like really big on that. And so I volunteer a lot of my services to, you know, pregnancy care centers because I think my mom would like that. I don't know what Hebrews 12 means when it says, you know, we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. But I know what I'd like it to mean. You know, it's like a stadium center and we're all, you know, we're the ones out in this field right now and all the people who've gone before are like cheering us. And I think whenever I walk into a pregnancy care center and my mom's there, yes, my boy, yes, my boy. I don't know if she's doing that. She would be if that's the situation, I can assure you. But I'm speaking at this clinic, at this conference in Jacksonville, Florida, a few years ago. There's a couple thousand people there, and I'm the speaker, and so I'm trying to tell a story, and this was something I didn't even really think about, which is really a dangerous thing to do, is to talk, say something, and then afterwards say, "Ooh, did I just say that?" but essentially, what's happened in America since 1973, which was a time when the Supreme Court made a decision in America to legalize abortion. From 1973 until the present time, there's been close, they've been over now, but this, at the time of this meeting, there had been 55 million abortions. And so I'm standing in front of this crowd, and I make that point. I said, do you realize that since 1973 in Roe versus Wade, which is what the Supreme Court decision was called, because those were the protagonists, since 1973, we've had 55 million babies aborted in America. Now, let me just suggest something. Let me suggest that we find 55 million Americans that would like to be a voice for one of those children. Because they never had a voice. It wasn't as if they could say, "Mom, don't do this. This is really a bad decision." They didn't have a voice. So what if 55 million of us said, we want to be a voice, and we express that by giving $5 a year. Not a month, not a week. A year. You see, the problem of abortion in America is a failure in our culture to build a sense of the sanctity of life. That's the problem. And unless we deal with the problem, the root problem, we're never going to be able to address the abortion problem. And so my plan was, well, let's get 55 million people giving $5 a year. That's close to $260 million a year. And we're going to go into 50 states and we're going to, you know, fund some programs to build a culture of life in that state. I mean, what if we could do that? And everybody in the room stood up and applauded. And I'm thinking, what have I done? Because I hadn't thought beyond that, you know. I'm just saying, this would be a cool idea, don't you think? Well, we're going to launch it in January of 2014. It's called Five for Life. $5 a year. I mean, and I say that only to say this. I'm not trying to build, you know, money for my cause, but if you want to give me $5, that would be great. But I'm pointing out that I think the future of philanthropy is going to be in micro-giving. And I think one of your plans needs to be, you know, to engage others in making smaller gifts. And let me explain why. Let's imagine that we're walking through the galaxy. All right, we can imagine. This is like fun. We're going to walk through the galaxy. Ooh. Oh, look over there. There's a black hole. And so you walk over to the black hole. It's like going to the Grand Canyon or someplace, and you're kind of looking over. Whoa, you know, this is a black hole. And let's say that that black hole is your $500,000 budget or your $5 million budget and your $25 million budget, whatever the case might be. That's your black hole. And you reach into your billfold and says, "Man, there's this incredible need out there. And let's see here. I think I have, yeah, I've got $5. So here's a $5 bill. And I wonder if I should use my $5 bill to fund this $5 million need.
And so I'm sitting there, and the wind is blowing up from the black hole and the things like this. And I'm thinking there, well, is this $5 going to make any difference whatsoever? I really don't think so. So I don't think I'm going to do that. What we have to do is we have to bring dignity to the $5 gift. If you had 50,000 people giving you $5, that's $250,000. That's $250,000 a year. You know? And the realities are, you can be assured, we have social media, we have all kinds. When you see our program launch in January of 2014, you're going to see social media. It's going to be on Twitter. It's going to be on, you know, LinkedIn. It's going to be on every social media platform that we can find. You know, we're going to encourage people that we know, everybody that we know, to put it on their, you know, post, you know, and suggest to their friends, let's do the same. Let's see if we can get 55 million people to do it. Now, that's a national big deal, but the realities are you could do the same thing. But what we have to do, you know, everybody that can give $5, and there's a lot of people that can give $5, there's 80 million of them coming up in America. You know, everybody can give $5 and not really miss it. And they can be a part of something very, very significant. Because, and I'm convinced that micro-giving is really going to be a part of the plan for the future in philanthropy today. So I would just really encourage you, as you're looking at your organization, understand that things are changing. Anticipate now that you're going to have a 70% loss of income by the year 2018. Just take my word for it. We can come back in 2018 and you can beat me up if it's not true. But the reality is true, and I'm not really worried about getting beaten up, because you couldn't do it anyway. Because I'm still, you know, tough at 78 then. But okay. So, but the point is, just assume that you're going to lose it. They're going to be gone. These donors, you know, 70% of your donors are going to be gone. You know, what are you going to do? And you better start doing it now, because you know what? The water's going down.